All right. Welcome to Shabbat, January 21st, 2017. And we'll be looking at the triennial cycle. Our verses today are Exodus 19, verse 6, beginning with verse 6, to chapter 20, verse 26. And I think I might, though, cheat and begin in verse 5, since you didn't really talk about it last week. And then the corresponding Haftarah is Isaiah 61, verse 6 to 62, verse 4. Is that too loud over there?
Yeah, I
didn't
notice.
And so let's start with some prayer. Lord, thank you for your grace that covers us all. Thank you for bringing us here on Shabbat. Help those still on their way. Speak to us today. Show us new pearls in your word. And help us be able to live on your promises. In Jesus' name, amen. So, you guys are going to be doing some reading today.
You fall on hard times.
Thank you. Now I can write up, kind of. Do you want to get a paper towel or anything? Or a machak if there is one. Okay, so let's begin reading our section. And as I said, I want to pick up in verse 5, even though our official parasha starts in verse 6, and we'll see how that connects up to Isaiah very clearly. But I think 5 is part of the concept as well, so we can't exclude it from the discussion. So, Sheila, why don't you start for us?
Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "I'm going to come to you in a dense cloud so that the people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you." Then Moses told the Lord what the people had said. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, 'Be careful you do not go up to the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. He shall surely be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on him.'"
On him, it says?
Not a hand is to be laid.
That's in verse 13? Okay, so it says on him as in on the mountain?
Not a hand is to be laid on him as he's killed.
Oh, that's interesting. I see.
"Whether man or animal, he shall not be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they go up to the mountain. After Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them, and they washed their clothes. Then he said to the people, 'Prepare yourselves for the third day. Abstain from sexual relations.' On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning and a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed out from it like smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. Then Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him."
Nice. When Moses was speaking, the Lord was answering him with a voice. It's a continual verb there. Mark, you can continue on. On verse, at verse 20?
It's 19, verse 20.
And the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mount, and the Lord called Moses up to the top of the mount. And Moses went up, and the Lord said unto Moses, go down, charge the people lest they break through unto the Lord today, and many of them perish. And let the priests also which come near to the Lord sanctify themselves, lest the Lord break forth upon them. And Moses said unto the Lord, people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for thou chargest us, saying, set down the top mount and sanctify it. And the Lord said unto him, away, get thee down, and thou shalt come up, thou and Aaron with thee, and let not the priests and the people break through to come up unto the Lord, lest he break forth upon them. And Moses went down unto the people and spoke unto them.
And God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of their fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to a thousand generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. We shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. When the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain and smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us, for we will die. Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. God has come to test you, so that the fear of God would be with you to keep you from sin. The people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites this. You have seen for yourself that I have spoken to you from heaven. Do not make any gods to be alongside me. Do not make for yourself gods of silver or gods of gold. Make an altar of earth for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, your sheep and goats and your cattle. Wherever I cause my name to be honored, I will come to you and bless you. If you make an altar of stone for me, do not build it with dressed stones, for you will defile it if you use a tool on it. And do not go up to my altar on steps, lest your nakedness be exposed on it.
All right, so that's where our little parasha ends. Interesting little addendums there.
Yeah.
Kind of very specific things relating to altar worship. Okay, so let's go ahead and read the Isaiah passage. It's again Isaiah 61:6 through to 62:4. And of course, here we're also starting in after our such well-known historic prophecy words that we find in the mouth of Jesus in the Nazareth synagogue. You know, and we have songs about it here. Ruach Adonai Elai, Yan Mashach Adonai Oti. But here we're starting towards the end of it. After, you know, you're going to have beauty for ashes, oil of joy, or a planting of the Lord, all of that. And then we start in verse 6. Gary, do you have English? Do you want to read?
Yeah. Sure. Hold on, it's just opening up. And it's still, you know. Alright. Maybe it's not working. Hold on.
You want me to start?
Go ahead, yes.
Lift up your eyes to the heavens, look at the earth beneath. The heavens will vanish like smoke. The earth will wear out like a garment.
Wait, are you in chapter 61?
Oh, sorry, 51. Yeah.
Go ahead, Mark. You.
And he shall be named the priests of the Lord. Men shall call you the ministers of our God. You shall eat the riches of the Gentiles, and in their glory shall you boast yourselves. For your shame you shall have double. For confusion they shall rejoice in their portion. Therefore in their land they shall possess the double. Everlasting joy shall be unto them, for I am the Lord of judgment. I hate robbery for burnt offering, and I will direct their work in truth. And I will make an everlasting covenant with them, and their seed shall be known among the Gentiles, and their offspring among the people. All that see them shall acknowledge them, that they are the seed which the Lord hath blessed. I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he hath clothed me with the garments of salvation. He hath covered me with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decked himself with ornaments, and as a bride adorned herself with her jewels. For as the earth brings forth and binds, as the garden causes things that are sown in it to spring forth, so the Lord God will cause righteousness and praise to spring forth before all the nations.
Okay. Gary, are you ready to continue?
No.
Okay, Sheila, you can continue.
For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. For Jerusalem's sake, I will not remain quiet. Till her righteousness shines out like the dawn, her salvation like a blazing torch. The nations will see your righteousness, and all kings your glory. You will be called by a new name that the mouth of the Lord will bestow. You will be a crown of splendor in the Lord's hand, a royal diadem in the hand of your God. No longer will they call you deserted or name your land desolate, but you will be called Hephzibah, and your land Beulah, for the Lord will take delight in you, and your land will be married.
All right. So, what do you see as our big linking word here between these two passages?
The priests.
Mamlechet Kohanim, a kingdom of priests. And as I said earlier, I wanted to actually even go back to verse 5 because you also have, in verse 5, mention of Am Skula, a nation of treasure or of possession. Skula is quite a rare word in the Bible.
You started already.
If you will look at Ecclesiastes 2:8. I'm going to flip there. In Ecclesiastes 2:8, this is, of course, from the mouth of written from the mouth of King Solomon. Good morning. It says, I also amassed silver and gold for myself, as well as valuable treasures taken from kingdoms and provinces. That word, I don't know what your Bibles have, valuable treasures. What else do you guys have for that?
Yes.
Ecclesiastes 2:8.
And what are you looking for?
The valuable treasures. What do you have? Silver and gold after that. What does it say?
Treasure of kings and provinces.
Okay, treasures of kings. Yes. It says Sgulat Melachim. So the Sgula is this word we're looking at. This possession. This private property. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think it comes about 7 times in the Bible, not too much. I'm just counting really quickly, so don't take that number exact, but so a Bible dictionary would translate it a valued property, a personal treasure. And when it comes to kings, it's their property. It's a personal, private, valued possession of kings, which do not pass into the hands of the state. So you have that element of very personal, and it's their possession, and it's something treasured. It's something very valuable. And it's also connected to an Akkadian word, which was another Semitic language, you know, that we have many, many texts in, so it's helpful for us to understand words in the Bible that are more rare. So the Akkadian word is sikiltu, and it also there means a private property belonging to the king. So the same concept, private property, private possession that belongs to the king. So it's something very special, it's a treasure. And this is what God says to the people of Israel. You are an am skula. You're a people of a treasure. For the same meaning, we can also look... I'm going to meanings outside its usage here as a metaphor, because the metaphor is a metaphor. So first... Where are we? 1 Chronicles 27:3. We just looked at Ecclesiastes 2. 1 Chronicles 27:3. Sorry, I got that wrong. 1 Chronicles 27:3, that's right. That can't be right.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1 Chronicles 29:3. There's a mistake. Anyway. 29. It's so funny. In my memory, I was like, I thought it was 29. That's what you get when you follow notes. Okay. So in 1 Chronicles 29:3, we have, again, the words of... Who is it? It's got to be Solomon, yeah. Actually, we have the words of King David said to the entire assembly, my son Solomon. Okay. So, these are from David, David's words. In verse 3, he says, now to show my commitment to the temple of my God, I donate my personal treasure of gold and silver to the temple of my God, in addition to all that I have already supplied for his holy temple. This includes 3,000 talents of gold from Ophir, 7,000 talents of refined silver for overlaying the walls of the buildings, for gold and silver items, and for all the work of the craftsmen. Who else wants to contribute to the Lord today? So, his personal treasure of gold and silver. So in this case, it specifies gold and silver. Other cases, who knows, maybe it's an expensive stone, a precious stone. But it's what we see here is that it's a personal treasure of the king himself. And that's this word, skula. And David gives that towards the temple. Of course, the temple hasn't been built yet, but he wants to be able to give toward it. Yeah, I'm giving all my retirement here, so what are you going to give? Yeah, David was...
But the First Chronicle, it says, dedicated for house of my God.
Yeah.
But in Ecclesiastic, someone said, I took it for myself.
Sure.
But it's
because we're following this word skula. It's a personal possession. So it's something, it's a treasure that kings have, and that's outside, like, the kingdom, what's part of the state government. It's their own personal treasures.
That's personal for...
Yeah, so there it's for Solomon. The other one is David's, and he donates it out of his own will.
David donates it, but it doesn't say in Ecclesiastes.
Right, no, and Solomon, he doesn't donate it. He actually gets it from other kings. If you read in the rest of the verse, it says he gets it from kings and kingdoms, surrounding kingdoms.
Okay, but...
And we have stories of Solomon getting treasures from, like, the Malkat Shva, the queen of Sheba, comes and gives, what is it, like 10 camels or something? Or 50, something ginormous.
Even to the rest of the text, you know, it's all for myself, for my heart, for the joy of my labor, etc. So it's not dedicated to anyone but for himself.
That's
not
right.
Like his father, David.
That's right. But I think Solomon's point, though, is even pursuing all these things, like he's trying to prove how much he had, and even that didn't bring joy in the end by itself. So he has to prove, like, I amassed treasure and this and that.
That's why he backslided in his life.
But maybe. I guess there are many reasons to backslide in late life, but may not be. Back to our text in Exodus, though. This is this concept behind the word sgula. So when God tells the Israelites, you're going to be my sgula, he's saying you're going to be my special treasure, like my personal...
What chapter?
Chapter 19, verse 5. And then... And of course, it says, if you will diligently listen to me and keep my covenant. So it is a bit of a two-way street, but he's saying, I've chosen you to be that special possession out of all the nations. And so...
It all belongs to God.
It all belongs to God, but the Israelites are chosen as this skula, this special personal possession of a king. And... So that's one metaphor you have. And then the next verse has another metaphor, another word picture of kingdom of priests. And this is, and a holy nation. So maybe those two kind of go together as well.
Well, this is reiterated in
Peter's. We will. We are going to look there. But stop for a moment and just think, like on its very base level, what would that mean? Kingdom of priests.
Doesn't it say that Israel was his firstborn?
It does.
The firstborn used to be a priest, but that when Aaron became the leader of the kingdom of the dead, he was the redeemer. So the firstborn was no longer the priest, right?
I don't know.
Say also a promise for...
Where did you get that the firstborn was the priest?
That's what it says.
Where?
That's the whole concept of the Kidyon HaDin. Is that the firstborn of the family was the priest of the family.
Before Aaron's family was chosen.
But where does it say that? Where you're saying that is what you can read between the lines based on the fact that you have redemption of the firstborn.
That's what's understood as the Kidyon HaDin, to redeem them so they no longer have to be the priest.
I haven't heard that understanding. It's interesting. Certainly, Israel is also called the firstborn, and he's also called my chosen one. So, and some of those same metaphors are applied to Jesus in the New Testament. My chosen one, my firstborn. And if you're looking at the early translations of this text, Kingdom of Priests, we have in Aramaic... Sorry, not the kingdom of priests. Going back to the skula, this word of special possession. We have that you're going to be chavivin mikol amemaya. So you're going to be beloved. You know, chaviv or habibi. You're going to be beloved of all the nations. And then you're going to be, before me, you're going to be kings, priests, a holy nation. That's what it says in Aramaic. So they've split this metaphor. Instead of a kingdom of priests, you're going to be both kings and priests, a holy nation. I don't know, maybe it's very similar.
Do we have any priests today on earth?
Do we have what today?
Priests. In this concept.
I don't think so, because we don't have a temple.
This is the reason, or for other reasons?
Well, there
he,
are...
He is our chief priest.
He is? You're talking about Jesus.
On earth now, who's supposed to...
Okay. But what does it mean to be a kingdom of priests? And then, of course,
the whole thing is so radical. You know, I'm going to have... When you think of gods and people, you're going to be special to me. You know, like, beloved.
Yeah.
My treasured possession. And then you're also going to be completely dedicated.
Yeah.
In a very high way. You know, not just... You're going to be priests and kings. You're going to be very dedicated. It's really an incredible bond.
Yeah.
People.
Well, also, it's interesting because this is right before they're given any of the commandments. So what is their concept of priesthood? You know, they're coming out of Egypt. Egypt had priests.
That's why they came out of Egypt, was to serve God.
No, for sure. But like when you think of what did these words mean to them? You're going to be a kingdom of priests. So what is a priest?
But was it also kings? You're going to be kings and priests? Yeah, maybe. Or maybe
some,
a king.
Some people priests. Interpret Tormin to be princes.
To be what?
To be princes.
Princes?
David used that term for his sons. And
they weren't proper princes. They weren't proper priests.
They weren't priests because they weren't
so you're saying the word Kohanim maybe doesn't really mean priest. It's more of a prince?
Some people say that.
Could be. But then the next thing says Vegoy Kadosh. A holy people. And holiness tends to go with priests and not princes. So this kingdom of priests, like if you look at later, obviously they don't have the law yet, but if you look in the book of Leviticus, you'll find that priests have special requirements. It's harder to be a priest than to be everyone else. There's special requirements they have to do. Like they can't just marry anyone they want. They have to marry a virgin. Like it's like there's rules for everyone, and then there's rules for priests that are even more specific. And they have, of course, they are dedicated and they are purified. Yeah, in many ways they're a mediator. I mean, I often think of a prophet more as a mediator, as we see in this selection. We have Moses bringing the people's word to God and God's word to the people. And that's very much the role of a prophet.
Yeah, this is talking about the whole nation being priests. It's not just
right.
About one tribe.
And a holy nation.
Right.
A holy nation. Whoever talks about holy nation.
So the rules for the Kohanim don't apply to a regular Israelite.
No, I'm not saying literally that the rules for priests would have to apply then to the whole nation. But they're taking the metaphor, like if people are familiar with the concept of priests, that they're specially set aside to do a function in the temple, it's using that metaphor saying, in the whole world, you're going to be like that. You're going to be specially set aside to serve God. As if there was this temple and this nation is chosen to be a special servant to God.
But inside that, you have your hierarchy. You have your Israelites, you have your Levites, you have your Kohanim.
Sure.
You have your different levels inside.
But not here.
But here again, I'm thinking...
This is the whole nation.
Here, it's talking about the whole nation. I don't think... Obviously, it's not saying everybody is a priest, because later we get very clear guidelines. No, only sons of Aaron, only this family, only that family. So it doesn't mean everyone in the nation is now a priest in a literal sense, but it's giving you a metaphor. And in the same way you understand priesthood as someone specially set apart, understand that you as a nation are specially set apart for a specific function. Like priests were set apart to do worship in the temple. The Israelites were set apart to worship God and to somehow be that... specially exemplifying to other people, and it's coming with a lot of responsibility and extra, you could say, precautions that they have to act in.
But he was asking if they have
Yeah, no, there are descendants of the priestly family today, sure.
But they didn't have priestly services. They have got the following and it's a code. They thought they had
to. Yeah, in today's world, though, I would say that it's very different. People come, what they have seen in the world, like when you hear the word priest, if you're coming from the Catholic Church, you know, you think of a Catholic priest, right? Catholics have priests?
He is God. He has understanding. He can forgive sin.
Yeah, and so...
Especially last year when Pope said the year of mercy.
This is way before Catholics. You know, this priest is a totally different thing, and yet other nations had it. You know, if you went to Egypt, they had priests. If you went to Babylon, they had priests.
Yitro
was a priest of Midian. And so it's interesting, because it's like an international thing. Everybody knows what a priest is. Today, it's kind of more like an anachronism, because we don't have, maybe some people do in the Far East. We don't have the same concepts of temple and... Yeah, maybe the Far East, like you go to Thailand, you see all these temples everywhere. Then that culture would have more of this concept of priest.
But every
that's true.
Up in the heavenly temple.
But
not any earthly temple.
But leaving temple aside, this metaphor of priests is a remaining one because we get it later on, right? You mentioned earlier. Let's look at 1 Peter 2:9. And these are interesting words. When you read the New Testament, it's helpful sometimes to think who was the author writing to? What was their context? And I don't know if I have a full answer for that, who 1 Peter was writing to. But the letter begins, "To you in the diaspora." And so to me, that implies at least some of the people he's writing to are Jewish believers.
Which diaspora?
The diaspora of the Jews in Peter's day. And so in chapter 2, verse 9, he says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood." The same words as the Septuagint. You notice it says royal priesthood, not a priesthood of... Wait, what was it? A kingdom of priests. So it's actually taking the Septuagint translation here. A holy nation, a people of his own. And that people of his own, I think, would be representing the Am Skula. So that you may proclaim the virtues or the excellence of the one who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light.
Yes, he is writing to the Jewish, but the converted Jews.
Of course, yes.
Believe in him.
Yes.
Not anymore to the Jews or Israelis.
He is writing to Jewish believers.
Jewish believers, yes.
And possibly those added in. I'm assuming most communities of faith in the diaspora who believe in Jesus would be a mixture of Jewish believers and those who had been added in.
According to Paul, there is no Jew, no Greek, no male, no female.
Yes, and yet you are male and I'm a female, right?
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
there's none in, when you're looking at equality and spiritual value, there is no Jew or Greek. There's no male or female. There's no slave or free. I totally agree. But when you look in, you know, actual physical world, there are Jews and non-Jews. There are males and females.
Yes, but there is, you know, the Israel of God is different than the That's what I'm, is that I read it?
Yes and no. If you look, if you want to look at the Bible in a holistic way, the Israel of God has always been more than natural Israel. He's always said, if you, in our very text, it says, if you obey my commands, you will be my chosen people.
Okay.
He says in Deuteronomy, don't think that you can get away with it and like the well-watered plants are going to cover your dryness. Like, no. If you separate yourself, if you don't have the faith, you're not going to be part. So it's... So it's
necessarily that the descendants of Abraham is a Jew or a Jew. The real Jews who believe in Jesus. You know, in Romans 9 and... go and see it. Verse 7 and 8 and 4 verse. There are two Israelites today. We Christians who believe in Jesus, we are Israel, the Israel of God.
Well, not... We are part of Israel of God. I would say we're grafted in, but there's still an Israel. And there's still an Israel of God. There's still an Israel.
If, but it's not of God. Israel of God.
Well,
the flesh.
Then you would say it was
like,
never of God.
Like the Israel.
If you say now that there's no Israel of God, then there never was. Because what is true today was true then. It's always based on God's grace. It's not based on what people do or don't do, but it is based on their attitude of seeking him and trying to follow. Yes.
The word grace, you know, is
yes.
By faith.
By faith and grace, but it's all, the faith is all connected to God and his grace.
It's his covenant anyway. It's his commitment.
It's his covenant.
It's not really our anything. It's his commitment. His choice.
And the truth is, when you think about it, if you have a problem applying any of these concepts to today's world, what makes us think it would have been any easier in that world? Why would this concept be any easier then as it is now? And if we can't believe it for now, can we believe it happened then?
Because you had a group of people there who were obviously just people. Now they're scattered all over the place. Nobody knows who they are, you know. Look at Israel, for example. You had two diasporas. You had Israel. They were scattered. And then Judea was scattered out 150 years later. But they were all part of Israel. You know, it's not just the Jews, it's Israel.
Okay. You're saying it's not just the Jews, we get the term Jew after the exile, where Israel includes, Jew comes from Judah, because the people you could trace after the exile were those coming from Judah, Bethlehem, Judah and Benjamin area. Yeah, from Judea. And
they were publishing those people who came back from Israel, exile.
I think the Bible warns against constantly both the concept that you can feel secure either in just a pure bloodline or just in purely claiming a claim of faith. Neither of those things will secure you. That if you think that blood is somehow magical, or if you think that somehow uttering a statement like it is like a magical incantation that will save you, neither of those things work like magic.
So what do you mean?
You need to be faithful. You need to walk before God. You need to be a child of God, and that involves. Balls.
So that's why it says here, it says, if you keep my covenants, if you keep the agreement here, then this is what you will be.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not just a simplistic, it's not just a simplistic sort of blood purity, and it's also not a magic incantation. So I think Christians who say that, you know, just say the Lord's Prayer, and other people who say that, oh, it's just, if you can trace DNA, you know, that's going to save you. I think both of those notions are wrong. in some kind of some. But there are elements of it. There are elements of it, of both.
However, you kind of introduced this element of salvation, where it's not directly put that way in our text. I mean, later you can extrapolate, but like to be this chosen nation, what did that mean for the children of Israelites in the desert and when they moved into the land of Israel? What did that mean for them?
Well, it's like this big ceremony that's very frightening and powerful. And then you can see why. Because following which we have a description of behavior and then an incredibly detailed description of behavior. And all these things have to be obeyed, it seems, or else.
They were supposed to be an example.
You know, I mean, you can see why.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be an example of God's will on earth to the nations. You know?
Right. And somehow specially like serving him.
It's not like an honor of kings, luxury. Now you get gold and silver from the Egyptians and you go off on your merry way. In fact, the bar is just way higher.
Yeah. Even though they do, in the Isaiah passage, they do get the gold and silver of nations.
But
it's because they're acting within this position, not anything personally that they do.
Yeah, but what Danny's saying is you don't get the gold and silver because of your DNA.
True. No, I totally agree.
Your proclamation.
You don't even really get it. You have to turn it over. You know, either have to turn it over to the temple or to social justice. Or, I mean, you know, just you're just a holder of wealth.
And yet God
so much responsibility.
And yet God is incredibly gracious because he says, just because I put my name on you, I'm gonna be so full of mercy and grace that you know, oftentimes you're a complete bumbling, you know, rebellious people, and because I'm gracious, I'm gonna save you because I'm on you. Or the guy on the cross. You know, the guy just said, you know, I don't deserve anything. I've done nothing, but, you know, Lord, remember me when you go into your paradise. And that was enough. He just showed just the most minor bit of remorse. And that was enough.
Yeah, but, you know,
so there are, you know.
The question that I have is, Jesus, he says, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments.
Right.
And then they get into this whole thing about legalism.
Who's they? Who's they?
Paul, he's talking about the works of the law and so on and so forth. They're not going to save you. But there's obviously a code of conduct, you know.
They might not save you, but they might lead to your maturity and your betterment. Just because something doesn't save you doesn't mean it's worthwhile. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure, but there is.
Just like as Christians, I don't get saved because I come to church every week or I pray this amount or do this or that. But coming to church every week is a good idea. Praying is a good idea.
But there is a certain behavior expected. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
And it's you know, it's not a matter of legalism. It's a matter of that's just the right thing to do. You know,
yeah.
The fruits of the Holy Spirit, whatever it is.
Right.
You know, that's just where people who make this proclamation should be.
Yeah, it does add responsibility. Claim certain thing and then act. You claim certain thing and then act hypocritically.
Well, it's like in a kingdom. If you've been watching the Queen, the Crown, right? You have it's a series on Netflix about the Queen of England, the one who's currently alive, Queen Elizabeth. And so you're constantly seeing that she's torn between being just a regular person, wanting to do regular things, and having to be queen. Because being a queen means she has to do certain things that are in line with the kingdom. And so there are many times where she has to sacrifice what she would do for herself to do what she should do as a queen. And I think that sense of special responsibility, special requirements, is really behind some of these metaphors. And
And it's true. I mean, what he's saying that, you know, like if you're a politician or a pastor, and if you're preaching a certain, you know, level of morality, and that yet you're having an affair, that
right.
causes that many more people to lose their
to
faith
be disillusioned.
Because you were such a hypocrite. Then
yeah.
I think you do get you will be, yeah, you know, calling for trouble. Yeah, to whom was been given much is expected. So, I mean, yeah, I think that does.
Yeah, and even though we have documentation in the prophets themselves of how, like you were saying, how completely messed up some of the priests were. Not just the people of Israel, but the priests within Israel. Like when Isaiah says, you know, your tables are full of crap and vomit. Like, whoa. He's talking to the priests. Like, they're off, like, what are they doing? You know? Getting drunk and sick all over the table? I mean, that's hardly becoming of a priest. And that's like, that's terrible.
That's more the role of the king, meaning I get to do what I want because I have this amount of power
mm-hmm.
and this amount of money. So he's calling them to a much different standard.
A whole different standard. And it's a standard of holiness that's even a higher requirement, maybe.
I mean, in a sense, the priests were the first kings. You know, it wasn't until Saul and God didn't want it. But it was Samuel who was really ruling, and he was the priest.
Yeah, he was interesting, because he's a priest and a prophet, Samuel.
Right, but his main thing is he's a priest.
His main thing is a priest.
A little ruler.
And yeah, it functioned. That's what he was saying. A priest essentially originally was kind of like that. Yeah, so for us, as grafted into this royal priesthood today, and being a holy nation, you know, it's something to ponder about. Like, what does that mean for me? You know, what does it really mean?
It means you're a treasure.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, in a sense, it gives you a confidence that if you are seeking to follow God and you are listening to his voice, he does, you are his child in a special way. Even though, like we had in our text in Exodus, the whole world is mine, right? So the whole world is God's. Every person is a child of God in that sense, that he created everybody. But we who, through faith in Jesus, have actually you know, made that commitment to follow him, you do have a special place with him. So there is that.
What does it produce, faith in Christ? It should produce actions.
Yes, it should produce fruit.
Fruit, yes.
Yeah, it should produce actions that are
so
like our Father's.
If we love Jesus and keep his commandments, but well, the fruits that we produce is not according to his commandments.
Well, why not?
Take the whole Christian world, they don't apply all the commandments.
It's true.
Especially the fourth commandment.
It's true. Well, we just read the Ten Commandments in our selection, and most Christians tend to...
themselves a holiday other than...
Well, here's why. Here's why. They separate commandments that seem to be more moral things from commandments that are connected specifically to ceremony. And so it's because of that, the ones that are more ceremonial belong to...
The ceremonial commandments written by Moses in a book and put outside the ark, but the Ten Commandments are
in the ark.
Tablets of stone inside the ark.
Well, you know, there's some debate how much was actually in the Ark of the Covenant, how much of the law.
In our wisdom, our understanding, we can't rationalize. We cannot rationalize by ourselves. When we rationalize, we are following him, the devil.
Well, if we're not going to rationalize, then we need to look at the full law. And there was a time in history where God gave the full law. And actually, when he said in Leviticus, I want you to bring me a goat, he meant, bring me a goat, you know?
Okay, that's ceremonial.
Yeah, it's exactly the point. It's ceremonial.
Inside the ark. Mm-hmm. This is the covenant that he made with the Israel, the children of Israel.
Yeah.
And he promised in somewhere in Jeremiah that he will write his law on our hearts.
Sure.
This is the new covenant.
And he promised it to Jeremiah, who was living many hundreds of years, well, not many hundreds, but hundreds of years before Jesus. And so it shows you that even in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament, there's a consistency in God's character. There was always this need for God to write it on our hearts. Us trying to follow it on our own never led to success. We can't do it without God. Israel couldn't do it without God. We can't do it without God.
But he's saying that if you keep these commandments, and these are the commandments he's talking about, he says, then you will be this people.
Right. That's true. He does say that. If you keep these commandments. However, look at the end of our text. Like, we have the Ten Commandments given. But then he also goes in verse 22, chapter 20, verse 22, he goes into very specific commandments about the priests going before the Lord and sanctifying themselves. This is a ceremonial concept. It's like so foreign to our world that we still have trouble understanding what this means. And so there are very specific ceremonial laws that are given as well as the Ten Commandments to be this special set-aside possession.
It's not anymore like the church.
No, I mean the ceremonial stuff basically has to be radically reinterpreted once you don't have all the elements. For instance, once there's no temple, you can't bring a goat to God.
Oh, yes, but you know, it's clear in that those commandments, ceremonial commandments, are nailed to the cross. So everything...
That actually is not so clear. It doesn't say the ceremonial commandments are nailed to the cross.
It
doesn't say that.
So when this doesn't say make an altar, you're not to make an altar, you know, like Abraham did.
Mm-hmm.
They made altars in different places, but is this talking about just the Temple Mount specifically?
You know, it's interesting because, of course, Moses is after Abraham, so it's hard to say.
But they don't have the temple yet, either.
They don't have the temple yet.
But they're still being willing to do sacrifice.
And even, we're out of time, but the interesting thing when you're reading this passage, you can look at, if you think about the location, when it says Moses went to God and said this, and God told him, go back to the people and say this. Was he going up and down the mountain this whole time? Or was he going, like, this is before the tent of meeting, before the tabernacle? How is he meeting with God? Where is he? It sounds like he's going back and forth physically from one place to another. So he's going somewhere to meet with God. But then in one of those meetings, God says, come up on top of the mountain. So it seems to be a different place.
He's not writing the Ten Commandments here either. It doesn't talk anything about the stones. Remember how it's written in the
Well, it gives him.
It's given to him, but it does, because he comes down. See, he comes down with the first.
Right, right. We have that later on in the book.
We don't hear him talking about the stones here. Right?
Sure, but he's.
They are written down there.
And the story is given to us much later, and so. They can tell you, this is the law that was given, and there we have the Ten Commandments. And it doesn't have to focus on whether he was carrying the stones right then or just reciting it. But those were the laws.
Those are the only laws that are written in the stone, though, right?
Right. Presumably, verse 22 to 25 are not written in the stone, but they're interesting because they seem tacked on here, like, you know...
But these were erased.
You know, they weren't erased.
You know, go to Colossians 2, it says he erased all those sacrifices.
Let's put it this way. The whole world is being erased. It says the things of the world are passing away. And when Jesus says, until heavens and earth pass away, not a jot or tittle of the law will pass away.
What is the law? The law is the Ten Commandments.
But you're interpreting there. Jesus didn't say the Ten Commandments. He said the law. He said the when he's, in fact, he said nomos. He says the most inclusive term, like Torah, that kind of includes very much. And I would say it would, at a minimum, include the first five books of the Bible. And so if those don't pass away, it's true that the whole world is passing away. So in some senses, then the whole law is passing away. But in as much as, you know, we are, and this world is, and creation is, so is the law. But as long as creation is here, the law is also here. How you interpret the law and live it out, these are big questions. And that obviously we don't have enough time for. But God's law is eternal. Otherwise you have to throw out kind of half of the Hebrew Bible as not really God's word because it says it's eternal. And then what do you do with it? Or you have to weed out things and say, well, I'm going to take this part of the law, but not that part of the law.
But all those ordinances and sacrifices all point to Jesus.
Didn't Jesus do that to some degree? Because when the woman was caught committing adultery, he changed the law. You know, according to the law, she was supposed to be stoned.
He just says he didn't condemn her.
But the law is you're supposed to pick up. The witness is supposed to pick up.
Well, we don't have time to go into all of the detailed discussions, so I'll leave you to keep thinking about it. And Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Next week.
Yeah. Here, I'll give this to you okay. Too.
Right, I mean, there are things that Jesus.